On today's episode, Michael and Ryan talk about their brewing profiles and how they differ from each other and everyone else that brews. Cheers. Hi, and welcome to another episode of Brewless in Law, where beer is thicker than water. My name is Ryan, and all with me is always my brother-in-law, or brother-in-law, Mike.
How you doing, Ryan?
Doing well. How about you?
I'm doing well. I was fortunate enough, I'm at Ryan's house at the moment, and I'm getting to partake in the last of his delicious New England IPA. So I'm not going to pour one out because that would defeat the purpose, yes. But can we just
cheers
to the last glass of a true legend.
I'm about to say I was surprised that's gone. Like, I mean, it was good. And I was drinking fast. It, but like, man, did I go fast.
That's what you get for making 3 gallons.
I know. It was the first time brewing it. I don't know what it's going to turn out. I'd rather have 3 gallons of good beer than 5 gallons of bad beer.
Fair point.
About Sad Panda.
Fair point.
As we talked before, in this podcast, we are amateur brewers, and we are going to share our stories, our experiences, and even our aspects on how we brew at home right now with whatever we can find. Like, we're not professionals in any way, shape, or form. We've been doing this combined, 10 years combined?
Sure.
So, we're not even close. We don't know what we're talking about. Well, we like to pretend we know what we're talking about. So we are going to dive into our first sip first, which is why it's called First Sip. And we're going to talk about what is the book you are reading right now. So, Mike, what have you been reading?
All right. I've been real deep into the Expanse series by James S. A. Corey.
You're reading that a lot.
It's a sci-fi. Yeah, it's a big boy. I'm on like book 6 out of, I think, an eventual 9. I think he's released 8. Ooh. Apparently James S. A. Corey is 2 people, which is weird, but there's an Amazon Prime show. Haven't watched it, but would highly recommend the book series. It's like kind of futurism. Humans have colonized like the asteroid belt and Mars and several moons, and the story all kind of takes place in that context. To give anything else away would sort of spoil parts of the first book, so I'm not going
spoil.
To but if you're a sci-fi person, I can't recommend the series enough. Very good.
I have been reading, and I've been like, I'm not the greatest reader. I'm very slow on reading, so like, I try and do a lot of young adult. And I'm kind of intrigued by a lot of young adult, like Percy Jackson. But I have been reading...
Keeping yourself young.
Yes, keep myself young. I am old, so I gotta keep myself young. I've been reading the Artemis Fowl series. I am on the final book of it, so I'm working on that. And then also, I just read it on and off, Ready Player One. I love that book, and the movie was pretty good. But the book is phenomenal. If you ever have any nostalgia for...
The 80s.
anything 80s or even 90s. Like anime, movie, books, comics, video games, that you'll find something, they'll mention something you know. So that's still, what I've been reading.
Still got to get to that one.
Yeah, you do.
I remember reading Artemis Fowl as a kid, and I don't remember any of the details other than that he's like a smarmy supervillain, but I remember really, really loving them.
Yeah, you know, they're really good. This is the first time reading them, honestly. My wife loved them, so I've been reading them, and she told me to stop at book 4, but I decided to go all the way to the end to book 6.
That's where I'm at. You decided that you don't do things 80%.
No. So, Mike, what are we talking about today?
So, today is going to be a tale of two brew days. So, we're going to kind of use this as an opportunity just to talk about the brewing process for anyone who is interested in beer and craft beer but hasn't tried home brewing for themselves. And then Ryan and I are each going to just kind of go over sort of our typical brew day, just so you can kind of get an idea of, first of all, the variety of approaches and just sort of how that tends to go. And then we'll just discuss some of the kind of differences between our approaches, what we feel the advantages and disadvantages of this are. Hopefully, if you've never brewed before, you'll come out of this with a better understanding of how the process works. And if you are interested in brewing for the first time, you'll have a better idea of kind of what a brew day is going to look like for you, what kind of equipment you need. Mm-hmm. And obviously there are great lists online if you're actually going to try and go out and buy some of that. I mean, if you have brewed before, hopefully this will just give you an idea of like other ways you can do things. And maybe you can help in comments kind of contribute to the discussion of the relative advantages and disadvantages of doing everything a certain way.
There's no wrong way of brewing, honestly. So
if you're brewing beer that you like, or that the people that are drinking it like,
that's as long great. As someone likes it, really. If I like it, I'll drink it. I don't care what it's made of. Well, let's take that back. Some things.
Funny you should say that, because there are four traditional ingredients in a standard beer.
Tell me how this breaks down.
This is going to be a very fast primer of the brewing process. It's not meant to be a tutorial. It's meant to be basically just, again, a primer, so anyone who hasn't done it before and doesn't know how beer is made can follow along with the rest of the episode. So the four traditional ingredients are water, grains, typically malted barley mainly, mm-hmm. yeast, and then hops. So a home brewer will design a recipe, often either from a kit that they buy at an online or an in-person local homebrew store. Or most people that I know, at least, will use brewing software to design recipes. If you're a very experienced brewer, you may be able to just do it without using a brewing software. I certainly can't. And I think even for experienced brewers, it's just nice to have calculations. You know, mm-hmm. no one is going to, in their head, calculate, you know, what the expected ABV of a beer is or something like that.
No, that's crazy talk.
So I think it's fairly standard to use brewing software. There are lots of options. I use one called Wirt. A paid version that most people use that a lot of brewers use is called Beersmith. Mm-hmm. I've never used it. It's supposed to be fantastic. I have been just stuck on the paywall. I'll try it out eventually. But so before starting, it's important to note that sanitizing is king in brewing. Yes. You have to make sure basically you want that yeast to convert all the sugars in your beer into alcohol, and they'll produce sometimes some other desirable flavors. What you don't want is bacteria or wild yeast doing any of that work, because they're going to throw off some funky, gross flavors. If mm-hmm. bacteria really get a hold, you may even have a beer that's unsafe to drink. So you'll typically start, you'll sanitize all your equipment. Generally, I sanitize and clean before and after a brew day. I use StarSan. There's a bunch of different homebrew sanitizers that you can use. So once you've sanitized your equipment, you'll get your water. Many experienced homebrewers may also make adjustments to this water for mineral content, water hardness, pH. You can play to different styles this way. You can try and match, you know, for instance, if you're making a Guinness clone, you can try and match the minerality of like Dublin water. Yep. You can do stuff like that. And a lot of experienced homebrewers will do those things. Or you can just use water from your tap or your hose. You can buy spring water from the store.
That's what I do. Well, first one.
So once you've got your water, and again, your brewing software will tell you how much water you need. The next step is to get the fermentable sugars out of your malts that your yeast will use to make alcohol. So again, typically these sugars come from malted barley, but there are other adjuncts, including oats, wheat, mm-hmm. Rice. You could use just straight sugar, depending on the recipe you're making. So if you're an extract brewer, you'll get either a dry powder or a liquid malt extract, where they basically, the homebrew supply shop you're using has done the job for you already. That extract already contains those sugars from a particular grain, or a particular combination of grains. So you just pour that liquid in, you know, mix it in with your water, and your sugars are there.
You get sugars and your flavors, from the grain. So you, like, it makes it slightly easy to compare to just a full grain. It makes less time. It saves you time, really.
And we'll discuss that a little bit more later. Yep. So if you don't do that, then you get to something called the mash step. So basically what you're going to do is you are going to get your own grains. And those grains can be different roasts, different mixes. That'll change the color of your beer. It'll change the flavors. You crush those grains so that the water can get in and access the sugars and the enzymes inside the grain. And then you're going to bring that water and grain mixture up to a specific temperature that's going to activate enzymes, mainly alpha and beta amylase, which are enzymes that break down the complex sugars in the grains into simpler sugars that yeast can eat and break down and make alcohol. So typically when you mash, you have to worry about something called efficiency, which is, you know, basically you can calculate theoretically how many sugars are in your mash. How many you actually get out, though, is a different story. And that's where efficiency comes into play. So different styles of mashing, you know, different efficiencies, different processes. It gets a lot more complex than that. But again, I'm trying to keep this at like a 1,000-mile view. So now after the mash, you have this kind of syrupy, sugary grain water. You'll typically then separate the grains from the water somehow. And what you're left with, that sugary water, is called wort. You'll hear that term thrown around a lot. So the next step is to boil that wort. And so this will help to sterilize it, to kill off any bacteria or wild yeast. And also during the boil, you'll add hops. And hops will contribute many things. They'll contribute bitterness. Mm-hmm. They'll contribute aroma and flavor compounds. So, you know, beers like IPA and pale ale notably have a lot of hop flavor. They'll give you that. Sometimes it's floral, sometimes it's earthy, herbal, fruity. They can contribute a lot.
Sometimes it's straight up bitter.
Sometimes it's just kind of rough bitter, yeah, depending on the hop. They also historically were used, the reason they were first introduced was because they contribute antimicrobial properties. So hops kind of act as stabilizers, and they keep your beer from getting overgrown with microorganisms. It lasts longer. Mm-hmm. That's why, you know, if you've ever heard the kind of historical tidbit that like India Pale Ale or IPA was more hopped because the British were trying to transport it all the way to India without it spoiling.
That's exactly why they did it.
So there's more hops. It was bitter. And then they were like, hey, this is delicious. And that's where IPA came from. But they did that because of the antimicrobial properties. During the boil, you can also add other things, the so-called fifth ingredient. If you're making a spiced style, if you're going to add fruit peel or any of those sorts of things to your beer. Then you cool your wort. Because basically yeast can't survive at boiling temperatures. So you once you're done boiling, you've got your malt sugars, you've got your hop flavor, you've got any other flavors you're going to add. You're good to add your yeast and turn that wort into beer. But you have to cool it first so that the yeast don't die, first of all. Because if it's too hot, obviously they'll die. But then also the temperature that you pitch your yeast at is going to affect the flavors that they give off, along with the strain. So you're going to go through a process called wort chilling, and there are many ways to do that. Once your wort is chilled down to your desired temperature, you'll pitch your yeast. And so again, there are the temperature makes a difference. There are many different strains of yeast. They all throw off different flavors. Some of them do better at higher temperatures or lower. Some of them can handle higher ABV beers. Mm-hmm. Some of them are more finicky. You know, so, and then there's an additional consideration of sort of how many yeast you pitch and how healthy they are. That is very important. Pitching temp is important. Mm-hmm. Complicated process. Let's just boil it down and say you pitch your yeast. So then you're going to close that into a closed container with some sort of airlock or blow-off valve to allow carbon dioxide to escape, but you ideally don't want anything getting mm-hmm. in. The fermentation will start. If your yeast are healthy, they'll begin to convert to alcohol. You'll see bubbles. It's always super exciting.
It's always fun to see those bubbles. I'm like that fish from Finding Nemo. It's like, bubbles!
Bubbles, yeah. I know. I feel like no matter how many batches I brew, I always hold my breath till I see bubbles for the first time.
Yes, agreed.
So then basically the yeast will take those sugars. They'll eat them up. They'll produce carbon dioxide. They'll produce alcohol, and they'll produce some other flavoring compounds. So then when they're done, you will have beer, flat beer, room temperature beer, probably, unless you're making a lager, but beer. And then, you know, you can measure how much alcohol you have by basically measuring what's called original and final gravity. So that original sugary wort is going to have a certain gravity. Basically, it's going to be denser. Mm-hmm. Because of all of those sugars and other things. And then as alcohol is made and those sugars are eaten up, that gravity is going to drop. And that difference between the original and the final gravity is what's going to give you your ABV. So you're like a percent alcohol. And so you can measure that using things like a hydrometer or a refractometer, these kind of standard brewing tools. once you've got that, and or you're just confident that fermentation has stopped, you haven't seen any bubbles for a while, some people will transfer to a secondary fermenter. You can do that for a variety of reasons, mm-hmm. to clear the beer, to get it off the yeast and all of the kind of like gunk that comes along from the hops and the grain. You can do it if you want to, you know, some people will add flavoring in secondary, or they'll dry hop, where they'll add like extra hops at that point to make it even hoppier. You can cold crash, where you basically put that fermenter in the refrigerator, let it cool down. That helps the yeast get out of solution. You can fine it with, fining agents like gelatin or biofine. And those are just kind of, those are compounds that, again, just help stuff drop out of solution to clear it out. And then, once you're through that phase, you've done everything you want to do, your yeast are done fermenting, you'll transfer that to your serving vessel. That's either going to be a bottle, a can, a mini keg, a keg. Mm-hmm. And then in that vessel, the beer will carbonate. If you're doing bottles, you'll
use priming sugar.
Yep. You'll use priming sugar if you're going to bottle condition, or you can put it into a keg and then basically like fill the bottles full of already carbonated beer. If you're doing that, or you're using a keg, you'll basically use a canister of compressed CO2 gas, and you'll pump that into your beer to carbonate it. Mm-hmm. You might want to age it for a while to let it mellow out. But importantly, at this point, beer's ready to drink. Yep.
Hooray beer.
So hooray beer. So that's the kind of the short-ish version of the process. I know that we didn't go into a ton of detail. Those are the steps, though. So, Ryan, why don't you just kind of describe, using your equipment setup, just briefly take us through what a typical brew day looks like at your house.
So I am not super scientific with mine. I'm very, very simple, very, very basic. I clean everything, make sure that's all good. But I have my recipe, whether I get it from online or whatever I made. I'm intrigued by these applications you're talking about, that you can put in your recipe and get all your stuff that you're supposed to get. I never heard of those, actually. So that's interesting to me.
You freeball it.
I freeball it. I mean, I'll get to the point, but there's a lot of things, again, I don't do.
If you're making good beer, it's not an invalid.
Exactly, yeah.
All approaches are valid as long as you're being safe.
Exactly. So,
and you like your beer.
So I'll get to the brewing process. I get my giant boil bucket or boil contraption.
Kettle.
Thank you.
Kettle.
Pot. So I put it on there. I brew 3 gallons. I try to keep it little as possible because I'm pretty much the only one that drinks in the house. My wife doesn't drink as many.
And for reference, a standard homebrew size is usually 5 gallons.
Yes, 5 gallons.
A lot of people do 10 as well, but 3 is definitely on the smaller end.
Yeah, I do 3. Just to make sure, because a lot of the recipes I have made, I'm trying for the first, second, third try. And if it's bad, I'd rather not have 5 gallons of bad beer.
Been there.
And, yeah, been there. So I got my pot going, and I get the water going. I do a mix of everything. Mike was talking about doing extracts. I do a nice combination of extracts and then grains, in which the grains you treat like tea. Put into like a nylon bag or cheesecloth type situation, and I put it into the kettle and let it sit there and steep. All the sugars still come out. I don't get to worry about having to clean and sparge anything out. It's all in a bag.
And just to clarify, this is at a high temperature but not boiling temperature.
Yes, right? Exactly. So probably you're not
somewhere
you don't
want
to burn
150
something.
150 range.
Yeah, 150, 160 is usually about where you get for that. So you brew the bag, you brew that about 30 minutes to an hour, depending on what the instructions say. Pull that out, you do your extract, it adds more flavor and more sugar to it. So it's a nice little mix of both. I do a nice hybrid.
It's not too easy, it's not too simple.
Exactly. I have nothing against, I have...
Not too complicated.
Yes. I have friends that do complete grains and have this whole setup, even more than what you have, because you do complete grains as well.
Yeah, but
like,
brew in a bag.
Yeah, brew in a bag. But I have friends that do full grain and like clean it all out. They have this, they have made the setup, and like,
yeah.
Your engineer is good on you. I'm not.
I feel like it's a personality thing. Like,
it is.
Some people love those details, and some people don't. And you just gotta find what works for you, what makes you enjoy your brew day.
Exactly. Because like I looked this up and I saw it. The differences between a full extract beer, which means you did not use any grains at all, a brew in a bag situation where like you have all your grains in this little bag and you just dip it in there like tea and you let it steep, to a full, no brew in a bag, full grain, you drop everything in there. The time difference is from a full extract, you save about 15 to 20 minutes to a brew in a bag, and a brew in a bag saves you on top of that another like 10 or 15 from the full grain brew. So like you do save time with the more extract you do. So I do, like I said, I do a nice little hybrid. Once that is done, I go into my boil. So that's when I do my hop schedule and the hops at certain times to get the right bitterness, the right flavors of each hop.
Sorry, real quick. No, go ahead. Are you using like a turkey cooker to, like a propane burner to heat, or do you do it on the stove?
I do it on a stove. I have a gas stove, so it's not.
Oh, okay.
It's not that bad. So it's still like I'm using propane. So it's just inside. And what's nice is the microwave's right above my stove, so I can tie the bag with the grains and just let it sit without having to worry anything. So it sits right into the water and everything. After the hop schedule, pretty much I follow everything on cue. I go out and attach my chiller and drop the temperature where it needs to be. I pitch my yeast how it's supposed to be done. I follow directions on the pack, very simple. I don't try to go too crazy with it. I know some people try and make their own yeast and everything else, but I keep it simple. After that, I let it sit. I wait for the bubbles. And then I, as Mike said, I do a lot of secondary re-racking. So I will take what was in the fermenter. So with
Once
it's done, yes. So all the bubbles are done. I don't see as many bubbles. I will take that with all the hops, the hop leftovers, the yeast leftovers, the grain leftover, all settle on the bottom, which is nice. So you then siphon it out into another container. And from there, I add my secondary flavor. So for instance, I do a nice session IPA, and I add tangerine peels. This is where I add the tangerine peels because you get a more flavor out of the tangerine at this point.
As opposed to like the boil?
As opposed to the boil. Now, I do some other beers where I do add flavor to the boil as well, but I find that if I want like a nice citrus or fruit flavor especially, it's better to do that then because the yeast is going to eat that up too.
Yeah, they'll eat any sugar.
Even if it's natural sugar from a fruit, it'll eat it up. So that's when I do a secondary re-rack, and that's where I put a lot of my flavors in. After about usually a week, it varies depending on the beer, but usually about a week, I will re-rack into my keg. So siphon it all out from that one, not getting the tangerine peels, and there still will be yeast. So like you go to siphon and not get that yeast still, and I'll siphon it into the keg. I turbo carbonate, which is literally I get my CO2 can. For a regular kegerator or any keg system, you're going to want just barely at like 10 to 11 PSI. And that's how you flow the beer into your kegerator. For turbo carbonating, you want to crank that up to 25. And what I do is I lay the beer on its side in a sealed keg and I roll it back and forth for about 30 seconds.
Agitate the crap out of it.
Agitate it. It gives it more surface to cover for the CO2 to cover. And then I stand it up, let it sit for a little bit, and then I disconnect the CO2. I release all the air that's inside the keg.
Extra pressure.
Yep. And then I repeat that process probably about a half dozen times until I get my carbonation. And guess what? It's carbonated in about an hour.
Right. So you can keg and drink in the same day.
Exactly. So
now are you trying the beer in between each of these six times? So that's how you know.
That's how I know how it is. So like usually I'll go three times right away. And then after that, I'll start testing it to see how the carbonation level is. Because you don't want to overcarbonate either. That's a bad thing. And then, enjoy. And I have no issues with that.
And then you have beer.
And I have beer. Yay, beer.
Yay, beer.
So that's pretty much what I do.
That is a typical brew day in Ryan's household. So I think now is a great time to stop for a quick break, and then when we return, I shall discuss a typical brew day in my household.
Sounds like a plan. That. See you guys then.
Hi there, I'm David.
And I'm Kate.
And we're the hosts of another Zelda podcast.
There are so many good podcasts out there, and some of them in particular concern The Legend of Zelda.
That's right, Kate, and we are another one of them. That is actually the name of our show, Another Zelda Podcast.
And in our show in particular, we talk about some of our favorite dungeons, characters, boss battles. We have top 10 lists.
Yeah, we do deep dives on game design and production aspects of the different Zelda games.
And we talk about our own experiences. We do some review episodes, talk about our challenges, our struggles, and our victories.
That's right. You know, really just almost anything that has to do with Zelda, we like to talk about it. A new episode comes out every other Friday, and you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and YouTube.
And you can also check out our episodes on our website, anotherzeldapodcast.com.
That's right. All right, we will see you there.
Okay, bye.
Hey, this is TC.
And this is Jim from the Studio Demands It podcast,
where every episode we take a demand from a hypothetical studio,
which could be you,
and challenge ourselves to conceptualize, pitch, and craft a film based on the stipulations
or the demands
we are given. We talk about movies all the time. Particularly, we complain about the choices made in the films we've seen.
We're nerds like that.
And, of course, like any good nerd does, we automatically assume that we could do better.
Even with the demands and restrictions that clearly must have been put on by a production.
So head on over to studiodemandsit.com and listen to our previous library of episodes. Our library of previous episodes. Our precious library, Jim. Our library of precious episodes.
You're a pirate, Smeagol.
Okay. So head on over to studiodemandsit.com to listen to our library of episodes.
And submit your demand for a future episode, too.
So go do that.
Okay, bye.
Okay, end of ad.
And we're back. So, Mike, I gave my process. I think it's time for you to give your process.
All right. Time to see how the other side lives.
Yes.
So, for my typical brew day, it's important to note that I have a toddler who is 16, 17
helps.
Months old.
She helps.
So, yeah, my assistant.
Yes, as you do
call
Kaylin,
it. Little Kaylin, and my co-brewer, my wife Haley. So, our brew day is typically structured around nap time. That is very important. So I write all my recipes in a free homebrewing app called Wort, W-O-R-T. So it's a cool app because it's free. I will say, like, you know, compared to what I've heard about Beersmith, like you get a little bit of jank, you know, because it's freeware. Like, that's kind of, you just accept that when you're getting freeware. But I've used it. I've had great success with it. If you're looking to have a homebrewing app and not pay for it, it's a really nice app. You can add, this isn't an infomercial, but basically, yeah, like you can pick a style. It'll tell you if you're within the bounds of that style. It'll tell you you're starting in Final Gravities. That's how I write my recipes. In there. And even if I'm going off of like a clone online, I'll still put it in there. So I sanitize all of the things. And then meanwhile, I start heating my water so that I can do a mash. So unlike Ryan, I don't use extract. I use a system called Brew in a Bag. So I'm actually getting crushed grains and I'm steeping them in water at about 150, 152 degrees, you know, plus or minus 5 degrees based on the recipe. So meanwhile, I basically throw my big 7.5 gallon brew kettle on a turkey cooker, like a propane burner, and I let that water start heating up. Meanwhile, I pre-measure out all of my grains and my hops based on the recipe. So I measure all that stuff out into bowls. When my mash gets to the right temperature, when my water gets to the right temperature, I add my grains, I stir them in. Basically what I do is I take this big brew in a bag. It's this big nylon bag. I put it across the entire brew kettle. I pour all the grains into the bag so they're steeping in the water, kind of how Ryan described. Mix those all up with a big old spoon. And my brewing app tells me basically, okay, if you want your grains to be at 152, you need your water at 157 or whatever. So then I know, because I'm using so many more grains, you have to account for that because the grains are room temp, the water's warmer. So add those in. Hopefully, once I mix it all up, it gets to the temperature I want. Put the lid on, and then I leave that for an hour. If it cools down too much, I'll turn the propane burner back on, and I'll heat it up a little bit to keep it in the right temperature range. So meanwhile, I make 5-gallon batches, and with the grains and the water, it doesn't all fit in the brew kettle at once. So I do something called a dunk sparge. So basically, I put part of my water in the kettle with the grains. Then there's another part of my water that I'm going to heat up to a different temperature, a hotter temperature, around 170. And that's a smaller, I have like about, say, 5.5 gallons in my brew kettle. I have this other like 2.5 gallons that I am heating up separately. And I actually use like a sous vide for that. So I'll put it on my stove and I'll use like a sous vide to just heat that to the right temperature. And so then basically once the mash ends after an hour, the way brewing a bag works, I use a pulley and I pull the whole bag up out of the water and just let it drip into the kettle. So all the drippings come out, but all those grains still have a bunch of sugars in them that aren't in the kettle yet. So what I do then, I take the heated water from my like little sous vide thing and I dunk the grain bag in that. It's like a secondary mash. And it basically that just like it heats the grains up enough that the enzymes stop. And like, hopefully it sucks out even more of the sugar. So my efficiency is a little higher. So I do that for like 10 minutes. Then I pour all the water together into the brew kettle. And since the grains aren't in there anymore, it all fits. I hope, does that make sense?
I think so.
So like basically I had all my grains in the big kettle, pulled them out, dripped them out. Then I dunked them in this other kettle for a while. Then I pulled them out with the pulley again. And then I just combined all the water into the big kettle. So, yeah,
makes sense.
So then I start to boil. So then I crank the propane burner. I boil them. I add my hops. And I use hop bags. They're made out of muslin. And, you know, yeah, I just kind of like string them along the side. I pre-measure. I throw them in the bag. And then I just toss them in and like kind of tie them to the side. So that boil, usually I boil for an hour. Then we do all this in the garage. So I bring it around back to where the hose spigot is. And I stick it on our table out back. And I stick this the wort chiller in. And that's just like this big copper coil that you run hose water through. The hose water's cold and it cools the wort. So I turn that on. That takes me a while, like 30, 40 minutes. And so then I chill it. I take a little sample out of there so I can get an original gravity reading. Then I use a siphon to transfer it into a keg. So I do all of my fermenting in kegs as opposed to any, you can use buckets, plastic buckets. You can use these things called carboys, which are just like giant 6.5-7 gallon, like bottles. Basically, they're just these enormous glass things, or they can be made of plastic. I use kegs for everything. I've got like a stash of them. So I transfer to a keg, I close it, and I just throw it in the fridge for a while. I don't pitch my yeast because, like, especially during the summer, if I want to get down to like 65 degrees or whatever, like our groundwater doesn't get that cold. So I'll just stash, throw in the fridge for a while. That depends on what I'm making. Sometimes I don't have to do this, but I'll throw in the fridge for a while. And I have this mini fridge that I use for fermenting. So I like basically have a temperature controller. I can set it to a specific temp that's like on the wall. So you can set it to things like warmer things like 65 degrees or whatever that a normal fridge doesn't want to go to. So I'll just let it sit in there and make sure it's at the right temperature for like 3 or 4 more hours. Then I'll open it back up and then I pitch my yeast. And I always use liquid yeast. I use a brand called Imperial and they pack, there's like I've been using them for the last 2 batches at least. And I've had good experiences. They put a crap ton of yeast in there, so you don't really need to worry about like using a starter or like growing them out or anything. So it's liquid. You just kind of mush it around, make sure it's all in there, and you just pour it in. There it is. And then I attach a blow-off tube to the gas out line of the keg. So basically there needs to be, the yeast is going to be creating a crap ton of CO2. You want to make sure it's got a place to escape. So I have this little plastic tube that comes out the top that goes into a glass of sanitizer water so that nothing can get in, but the CO2 can get out. Mm-hmm. So then after
you can do vodka with that too, actually.
That is a great idea.
That's usually what I do when I do that kind of
stuff. That's not a bad idea because the, it would probably get less. I don't know. The
It's the only reason I have vodka in the house, honestly.
The sanitizer. Shots fired. Earmuffs, Tito's. It's okay. He loves you. But the sanitizer is really bubbly. So when all the CO2 starts flying into it, it really bubbles up. Yep. I should try vodka. So that'll ferment out. You see the bubbles in the glass with the sanitizer in it. Once that's done, I will often cold crash my beers. So I'll take the blow-off tube off. I'll attach it to CO2, and I'll just throw it in the refrigerator and let the temperature drop under a little bit of pressure. At that point, when I do that, I'll take my final gravity reading so I know what my ABV is. And then I will use, since I have the CO2 and I'm using kegs, you can hook up a line between two kegs. Mm-hmm. You pump CO2 into the one with the beer in it already, and then you have a pre-pressurized keg that's empty. It has nothing but CO2 in it. That's going to be like your receiving keg you're going to serve out of. And you can just slowly bleed the CO2 out of that, and the beer will go over automatically. It's called a closed transfer. And so that's that's what I do now. I've literally done it once because I just got
our
grandpa built me a closed transfer tube. So I'll do that. So that's nice because it's totally free from oxygen. All the beer just kind of shooshes over from my fermenting keg into my final keg. I never do secondary. At least I haven't had a need to yet or in a long time. The beer carbs in there. I use a method called forced carbonation where I basically just crank the carbonation up to 25 PSI. I don't agitate it though. I don't roll it around. Mm-hmm. I just leave it there overnight. And then I'll turn it back down to serving temperature, 10 or 12 PSI. And I'll leave it for a couple more days.
Yeah.
So I could leave it at 10 or 12, but it would take a week or more to carbonate. This just speeds it up by a few days.
Yeah.
And then,
'cause you want beer.
Then I will drink my beer.
Yep.
And then the beer's ready. So that is how brewing works in the Newton household. So
now I can already tell there's a lot of differences between us.
There are. And these are things that you and I have discussed in, family events and other hangouts, but we've never really dug into it. So I think this is a great time to talk about some of the key differences between our brewing approaches, because I think it's a good opportunity to, I think it's a good opportunity to just sort of kind of discuss the pros and cons of certain approaches. So the first one I'm going to bring up is batch size. Ryan, I know that you do 3-gallon batches. I have always done a full 5 gallons, or at least around 5 gallons into my keg.
It's not a huge difference. I mean, it's making sure you have
a 2-gallon. It's a 40.
Well, yeah, but I'm not doing the same amount of hops that you're doing. I'm doing the right ratio because I do the math. I'm like, okay, this should be for 5 gallons, divide by 5. That gives me 1 gallon times 3. That gives me 3 gallons. So, I make sure I get the right ratio when I do it.
It's definitely, you can scale recipes easily. I think the biggest thing you brought up earlier, it's like if you're messing around with a new beer, if you make a 3-gallon beer and it's not good, you're out a little, you're still out the same amount of time, but you're out less money and you have to dump less. 5 gallons, if it's bad, that sucks.
Yes.
And I think that's the big difference. Now, for me, if I'm going to put the time in to do a brew day, I want as much beer as possible. And that's why I do 5. Again, I don't, we're just as a blanket statement, neither of us are trying to argue that our idea is better necessarily, but that's why his works for him. That's why mine works for me. And I think that's kind of how you should look at these brewing things. Like, there's advantages, disadvantages to everything. It's not betterness. It's fit. What fits what you want out of your beer? What fits your lifestyle? So, for water, I don't know if either of us mentioned this, but I believe we both use just unfiltered, unchanged Detroit tap water.
Yeah, we don't get into the nitty-gritty of making sure the minerals and electrolytes and everything else is fine. Well,
water minerality is something that's interested me. I'd love to mess around with it, but like honestly, like Detroit has, for anyone not around the Detroit area, like one of the sweetest things about living in Detroit or in the Detroit area is that our water is awesome. Like we have, I kind of get kind of judgy about it when I go other places actually, but like we have really good tap water. They don't use chloramine, which is a cleaning agent that's really bad for brewing that you kind of have to remove. Mm-hmm. It's very soft water, low total dissolved, you know, solids, low minerals all around. It's good for brewing. And so, you know, could you make some specific styles better by adjusting your minerals? I'm sure you could. I haven't had the need yet.
Well, I feel like it's a little bit off brand for us, going into, to bourbon, but like some people say a true bourbon not only needs to have that right ratio of corn in their mash.
It's the water.
It's also you have to have the Kentucky water. Yeah. Kentucky water to make it a true bourbon. In which I've had bourbon made here in Michigan. I've had bourbon made out in other parts of the country, outside the country, in different parts of the world. Bourbon really just needs that corn. I'm sorry for all those in Kentucky who might be listening to this, but the water can make a slight difference, but like you really won't taste that much unless you have really, really bad water. Like you use well water, well water could affect it.
Yeah, maybe. Because
of the salt and everything.
And I'm sure, like, you know, never having messed around with it, where neither of us can really claim to be authorities, but I think the thing is, I think some styles really demand a certain water profile, but if your water is good, and like, I know we have like kind of around a 2.5 to 1 sulfate to chloride ratio, and that ratio is especially important for how beer tastes. Like, that is right. That's pretty on point, or at least it's within range for a lot of beer styles. So, it's something you can mess with if you like it. I know like a lot of people say that it is one of those things you don't think makes a huge difference, but it turns out it does. It's just not something I messed with yet.
Exactly. And it's not something like if you're new into brewing and even like with our levels even right now, like we it's not really something you have to dive into. If you really want to get into it, go to your local grocery store and buy yourself some purified water and do it that way. Like, and that's a nice way of doing it if you really need to.
And if you're going to do that, I want to plug, there's like a free, it's actually an Excel spreadsheet, but Bruin Water, like Brun Water. It's a free spreadsheet that you can use to figure out like your water additions. And I have looked at it. Like I said, this is something that interests me. It's very easy to use. It's just, again, it's not something, I haven't made a style yet where it seems like our water isn't right. So anyway.
All right. So the big one that's about to be the difference between us.
Yeah. So I think one of the key differences, and I know Ryan, you said you messed around with sort of a little bit of everything, but you tend to do kind of partial extract. Whereas I do full grain brew in a bag. So having done a little bit of everything, what's your experience? You like comparing and contrasting.
Well, first of all, I'm going to say, if you're going to do any extract, do the liquid. The dry stuff is just a pain to deal with because it just gets everywhere and it sticks.
I've heard it gets everywhere.
Yeah.
Although I've heard that liquid, you have to be careful. You don't like char the bottom of your brew kettle. You got to really stir.
I mean, yeah, you're going to have to do that.
You got
to
stir the crap out of it while you're pouring it in. But maybe, like, and turn the heat off. I've heard that too. Turn the heat off.
I mean, you want to keep a temperature. You don't want to go too high. You don't want to boil it.
Yeah.
It's just like you do when you brew in a bag. But like with a simple, like all extract brew, which I've done multiple times. Actually, the Kolsch recipe that I make is a true extract recipe. I don't put any grains in it at all.
And at that point, that saves you a lot of time too.
Exactly.
If there's no grains. That's like, you're cutting the whole mash out.
Yeah, you're really saving yourself a lot of time with that. So I have no issue with the full extract. And I talk to a lot of homebrewers and microbrewers and stuff like that. Unless you are like a connoisseur, a lot of times most people really won't tell the difference between a full extract to a full grain.
Yeah.
It's very, very, you have to have the palate for it. It's kind of like you're a sommelier for beer. Like, you have to know that kind of thing.
I feel like part of it too is beer style. Like, if you're making an IPA with a very simple grist, no, it's not going to make a big difference. If you're making a super malty beer, then it might make a difference. That might be a scenario where you're like, all of a sudden, yes, it does matter. Or like, the maltster that you use all of a sudden matters if you're making one that's super grain forward. I can't claim to have enough experience to say like, oh, well, you know, this Pilsner malt is yummier than this one. Mm-hmm. I haven't used any of them enough. I think for me, now I do brew in a bag in part because I just like the romance of the idea that I'm the one getting the sugars out of the grains. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like I work in medical research. I do science for
science.
A living. Science. So I like that. The whole like conversion and like, I get a kick out of it. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's a good fit. I like simplifying things. That is not something that I want to simplify because I like the complicated. I like that it's complicated. And I will say that, like, I think it does give you, if you're making a malty beer, it's a lot easier to have options using grains.
Yeah.
Now, you could argue that, well, you could just use extract for your base malts mm-hmm. and then dunk your specialty malts, which is what you do a
exactly
lot of
times. Exactly what I do a lot of times.
And
yeah.
that more or less gives you that variety back. But I still think, like, if you want to use, like, you know, craft malts, malt makers or something like that, they may not make extracts. So you're limited mm-hmm. in that sense. But I think using like a partial system, you can probably still get a fairly complicated grain bill without having to ever go to all grain. I like it. I don't really think brewing a bag is that complicated. I bought a bag. I hung a pulley.
Mm-hmm.
I'll
say this.
That was all.
With the New England IPA that we just tapped out, it was a nice mix of both. So I got a nice pale ale extract that just set the tone for everything.
Yeah, it kind of laid the foundation.
And then, exactly. So then you can bring in your extra flavor malts and flavor of anything else, of grains, that you want to drop in there and get that extra out of it. I find it very... I live by the rule of KISS. Keep it simple, stupid. Like, I understand, I have no qualms with people who do, like yourself, full brew in a bag, or there's a full grain with the wash and everything else. Like, people go crazy with this stuff. I get it. You love the science of it. I am not that much into science, and yeah. I like
you
this.
You want to keep it simple. Yeah.
Exactly. So, I feel doing that. A full extract or doing a partial extract with a brew in a bag, with just teabagging, literally a teabag of grains. I saw that look.
Yeah. Poor choice of word.
but using that, it's just like, it's a nice balance of getting your base. And if you're going to add more to it, you can add more to it. If not, then you're good.
Yeah. No, I agree. I'm with you. Said, I feel like I get a little something extra out of my, I shouldn't say I do now. I feel like, I would say maybe going all grain is like buying specific golf ball brands. I think you hit the nail on the head where it's like, I'm sure it helps once you're really good.
Mm-hmm.
Once you're really, really good, I'm sure it makes a difference. Once you know what brand you like for every type of malt. But in the short term, like I said, for me, honestly, I think it's simple enough. I love the process of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, like I think I agree with keep it simple, stupid. But I think simplify where you want.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's a part that you like nerding out about, then nerd out about
it. Oh, yeah. There's nothing wrong with nerding out about.
So this is maybe a minor one, but I know you just kind of toss your hops into the boil, right?
Correct.
You don't generally use bags. I use muslin bags. I actually think that it's fairly common. I think most home, or at least a lot of, like, I've done some looking online because I get nervous about this stuff. Most people seem to just free toss.
Yeah, from what I see, and like, they're simple pellets. Like, you're not throwing in actual hops unless you actually grow your own hops. But
yeah,
like,
well, I mean,
throwing in the pellets, and like, because of how the timing is and when you throw it in there.
It kind of turned into dust and mush anyway.
It goes in there with the muck. I call it the muck of yeast, hops, yeah. and a little bit of like the bit grain yeah. that might have stuck with
mm-hmm.
it.
So I think the maybe the biggest difference is if you bag, first of all, if you want to, you can remove those at any point.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think most people do. I think even when you bag, most people just leave them in there till they've chilled and transferred. But those bags will be thick, thicc thick, and like, and there's a bunch of that gunk in there. And the nice thing about that is that that gunk is not going into your beer. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it's nice. In another sense, you have to, there are things you have to worry about. Like I often worry about, because all that gunk's just in there and it's not like getting boiled and kicked around, I wonder if my extraction is the same as someone who just throws their hops in free. I don't know the answer, but when I wonder about it. I kind of feel, I you know, I feel like because they're all stuck in place, maybe the hops in the middle of that clump of like goo aren't getting agitated as much, and the pop compounds aren't coming out of that the same.
That's valid, because actually,
I have no idea.
With the New England IPA, it was the first time I actually did the hops in a bag, because that's what the recipe said to do. And I was worried about that same actual thing. Like I was watching, I'm like, is like the hops in the middle getting like the flavors out of it? So I'm like, I'm literally just like going up and dunking down with it, yeah. Dunking it.
You're back like waterboarding your hop bags.
Like, get all the flavor out of here. Come on, do it.
Yep. Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I like doing it. It's kind of how I've always done it too. And it's just like, frankly, you know, you get into a comfort thing. I've like thought about just pitching them in, and I always just get cold feet and go, nah, knees bad. But so I guess next big difference, fermentation vessel. So there are a lot of options here.
Oh, there's
none of them are wrong. No. I will say, like, you use plastic carboys, yep. Which I think is basic. Fairly common. Yeah, fairly common. Plastic buckets, plastic carboys, both are commonly used, especially by newer brewers, because they're cheap. Very inexpensive. they do run the problem. Plastic stuff can kind of get scratched up during cleaning, and they sometimes need to be replaced more, like in the very long term. Mm-hmm. One thing I will say, fermenting in kegs, first of all, I'll say kegs aren't as expensive as you think. If you just look up, you know, on eBay or even Amazon or something, you can get used 5-gallon kegs for,
true.
There's not that much money,
yeah.
But, one thing that kills me, because I used to always ferment in buckets and carboys and like things that were clear, you can't see what's happening. You are completely reliant on that blow-off valve, yep. Or your airlock for bubbles. You can't see any of the croizin at the top, all that like that bubbly matter that forms while the hops mm-hmm. are for or while the yeast are fermenting. There's nothing visual.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I love that I can do a close transfer. I love that I can pressurize when I want to. I love that I can stash that. It's small enough to fit in a fridge, so mm-hmm. that I can, or in a mini fridge, so I can have temperature control,
yep.
Which is a big thing for me, especially because I think more than you, I like to dabble in lagers and stuff,
yep.
Where temperature control is really important. So that's kind of how I see it. That's the trade-off. Like, I hate not being able to... I used to love having my beers in... I'll probably still every so often ferment in a glass carboy so that I can see the bubbles, because it just feels good. I hate not seeing it. So I don't know. Do you have anything to add to that?
Well, the one thing I will say, for those who might not know, when you do a close transfer like that, the reason you're doing it is because you don't want the oxygen. Oxygen, as we know in our air, is not 100% clean. And so like there is the possibility of getting something in there.
Well,
so it's nice to do that closed transfer. So
yeah.
It's strictly, you're in a keg that's pressurized. You're going into another keg that's pressurized.
Yeah.
There's no oxygen at all.
Well, that's part of the problem, is that you can draw in, you know, yeah, basically you're drawing in not just oxygen, but like ambient air, which
yes.
has microbes in it.
Yeah.
The other problem is that oxygen as an atom can also react with like especially hop compounds and stuff, mm-hmm. and can give your beer this you know, oxidation off flavor, and that's obviously a problem too. It's a problem for certain styles more than others. I know that New England IPAs are notorious for it, although yours avoided any oxidation.
About to say, because I do not do anything. I actually, for those who are cautious now, like, you don't have to do that. You can literally siphon your beer and not have an issue, because I do it every single time. Like, I do have the ability to do it. I might need another keg, but to do it this regular way with the siphon too, it's not going to kill your beer. Like,
yeah,
there are odds of it happening, of course, because you never know what could be in the air. Obviously you can't see it, but like, most times when you just do a quick siphon from one carboy to the next, or one carboy to your keg, it's you might get some interaction there.
Particularly if you're being clean and you're sanitizing everything thoroughly. Yeah. Like if you do that, you're probably going to be okay. If you drink your beer fast, you've got a better chance of being okay. Like there's a lot of considerations. I also like, I just love the simplicity of it. It feels awesome just to hook up a transfer line, pull the vent cap on my like serving keg, let the CO2 out and just watch the beer just like fill magically. It feels good.
I like that.
The closed transfer.
Magic.
It's magic. It's not magic. It's science.
Now, I bet you the next one, the next step is probably our other big difference.
Which is?
The secondary.
Yes. Let's touch on that. So for me, no, I know you tend to like to add the, in air quotes, fifth ingredient to your beer a lot more often than I do. And that is often a great place to add. Secondary is often a great place to add it because you want it to sit on that secondary or that that additive, that adulterant, if you want to call it that,
for sometimes
like up to a week. And some people get queasy about having the beer sit in the primary fermenter on top of all that trub, all that sludge at the bottom. Once the beer's done fermenting, for me, I don't tend to worry about that much. If I'm going to add a flavor, honestly, I'll probably still just add it in the primary. But I think the prevailing knowledge does tend to be that you want to go to secondary first. For me, I'll say it's kind of just like another step. And, since I do everything in kegs, honestly, sometimes it's just like, I don't have enough kegs for that.
True.
You know, then I'd have to transfer and then I'd have to clean that keg immediately so that the beer could come back in. You know, I go from my primary keg into my secondary, then I have to clean the primary and like, not that I do clean immediately, but then it's like, then a week later I have to transfer back to use the first keg as a serving keg and then I have to clean the other one. And like, it's just complicated. That's somewhere where I like to keep it simple, stupid.
I'll give you that. With me, like, I think I brew about 6 beers on a regular basis. Of those 6, all but 2 have a secondary re-rack and will have secondary flavor added to it. So the only 2 that aren't is the New England IPA, which has nothing added to it. It's the only beer, actually, I don't add any
four
extra flavor to it.
Boys
the
and girls.
True 4 ingredient beer. And the other one, it's something I add a flavor, but it's actually at the very end of the boil. It's like the last minute of the boil. But everything else, tangerine pills, I'll throw in there, coffee, throw in there, cucumber water, throw in there, like this, those little itty bitty flavors. And I actually, there was, a couple friend of my wife and I's who got married and they wanted the brew for their wedding and I helped them with it. And they had 2 beers. One literally threw in a pound at least of dark chocolate nibs, and then little cocoa nibs, and then 2 gallons of orange juice into the secondary. Like that's, to me, that's a lot. Yeah, and it was a stout. It was a very good stout.
What?
Yeah,
orange juice and a stout.
They were trying to mimic like one of those chocolate oranges.
Well,
so they're trying to go with that.
2 gallons though.
Yeah, it was a lot, but it turned out pretty well. And then the other one, they did a beer that ended up getting strawberry puree in the secondary. Like it was literally frozen strawberry puree that I put into this car, my secondary for them, and it destroyed. I love you, Micah and James. You destroyed my kegerator because of all that gunk in there. But it was good beer. It was a different. It was a very, both beers very different. They homebrew and they're crazy with the flavors. But like the flavors work.
For them.
I give them credit. Like,
they meld. Yeah.
Yeah, they meld very well. Like that chocolate orange. You think like, especially with the orange juice. Like you think that'd be too much. It was just the right amount for it though.
Yeah.
I personally would probably did like a gallon, but like still very very good. And they're still learning because they're 2 years into brewing. Like they're very new into it as well. So the secondary, to me, the secondary is very important because that's where I get a lot of my flavors.
Well, and it's nice for stuff like that. Now, unless you are using some sort of chemical or heat pasteurization process, you're not getting all the yeast out of your beer in the secondary, but you are getting most because most of it is settled out generally if you wait long enough. And so, yeah, that's a consideration too, particularly like if you're going to add orange juice, There's a difference between adding orange juice and the yeast eating all of the sugars in the orange mm-hmm. juice and not. You know, yeah. you add the orange juice and all the sugars stay there. And so, you know, sometimes you can get away with it if you... Well, I'm not gonna. Well, I don't know, but maybe if you drink the beer fast enough, you can, and or you chill it immediately, you might be able to just get away with adding stuff that has sugar in it in secondary because you've gotten it off most of the yeast.
Yes, and I think that's it also comes down to helping that you don't make the most strongest beer in the world, because if you say, like, for instance, either one of those two beers I was talking about, whether the chocolate nibs and orange juice, or the strawberry puree, like you put that in the primary. With all the yeast in there when you first pitched it, that beer, I can only imagine how strong that would be.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you kind of lose control of the ABV at that point a little bit.
Yeah. But yeah, that's secondary.
So, yeah, so I, you know, I guess for sake of time, the last big difference is carbonation method. And I think both you and I use a keg-based method, since mm-hmm. we both keg. It's an accelerated schedule. I would say that I think they're similar. The big difference being that yours is maybe a little bit riskier than mine in terms of, you know, when you're rolling a keg around, you're drinking beer that day. That is fantastic.
It is.
You can definitely overcarb if you screw that up. So you got to be careful. I think your method of just tasting as you go mm-hmm. helps prevent, you know, most of that. I honestly just haven't mustered up the cojones to try it, because I would love to drink my beer same day. Mine, to me, cranking it up to 25 and then turning it back down, that forced carb method, and then just, you know, usually it's drinkable then, but it gets better over the next day or two. Mm-hmm. That's close enough for me, and as long as you don't forget to turn it down from 25 and you don't forget to vent it. I forgot that once.
Yeah.
And I opened the the top and just went, and it just smashed me in the face.
I have an extra CO2 tank.
You
got to
vent all that extra stuff out of the keg once you turn it back down.
Yeah, I do have an extra CO2 tank too, which helps, so I don't have to worry about that. So like that CO2 tank is strictly brewing only. And then I have the one that's into the kegerator, which is only at like 10 PSI. So it's nothing crazy on that one.
Yeah. So again, yeah, I think they're both kind of similar versions of the same thing. You know, if you need your beer right away, the turbo carbonation
turbo
method?
Turbo carb, yeah.
It's great. I'll probably try it sometime. I don't like waiting for my beer.
No.
So, but yeah, I hope that you guys all found that helpful, informative, entertaining, or something.
Well, I mean, everyone does it different. Like, we have our own ways. You can do it any way you want. Like, do the if you look up, and even like a brew kit that you buy, like most brew kits will be strictly extract and maybe a little grain. Like the Irish Red Vanilla that my roommate and I, Matt, did the first beer we ever did was mostly extract, and that's a red is a malty beer. Like you need to make sure you have a good flavor with it, and it was mostly extract. So, like, you're getting a good flavor out of it. You can do kits and all extract and
especially
still get
when
good
you're,
beer.
When you're starting, it's nice to just keep it simple. Mm-hmm. And again, it can cut out up to, you know, I would say 45 minutes. If you're mashing for an hour and all of a sudden now you're not mashing for an hour, all you're doing is stirring in some extract, mm-hmm. like, that's great. So, I think if there's one thing we can take away from all of this, you know, we were sort of careful not to discuss everything in terms of better or worse practices. And you may disagree, but I think the key for brewing and to pick up brewing as a hobby and to continue brewing as a hobby is to make it work for you. If you overcomplicate it, it's going to feel complicated. You're not going to have fun. So we hope we've kind of given you sort of two ways from our perspective that brewing can be done. If you do things differently, we would love to hear about it. You know, even though it may not be on the topic of beer, hey, if you have some great books that you've been reading that you'd like to recommend, you probably got sort of an idea of the type of books Ryan and I like. Mm-hmm. Share those too.
Exactly.
I'll check them out.
Now, where can they find us though?
You can find me and Ryan, for that matter, on Twitter at Brewthers-in-Law. That's B-R-E-W, Brew, T-H-E-R-S-in-Law, all one word. And Ryan, I believe there are a couple of other places where people can find you as well.
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter mostly. I have my personal one, which is Rambo Kuhn, RAMBOKUHN. My stuff that I brew is also tied to another Twitter account, which is Wise Old Owls Brew. And I also blog about brewing as well, which we'll probably cross some topics over here and there. But like that is hopbrewandblog.com. So we'd love to hear from you guys. Let us know what you think about brewing. If you got questions about brewing, like, I mean, we're not experts, but we can at least point you in the right direction on how to get there.
We are amateurs.
We are amateurs, as they say across the pond. Well, but to everyone, cheers. Hope you guys enjoy it then.